The gods of mere mythology had a great deal of nonsense about them. They had a great deal of good nonsense about them, in the happy and hilarious sense in which we talk of the nonsense of the Jabberwocky or the land where the Jumblies live. But the man consulting a demon felt as many a man has felt in consulting a detective, especially a private detective, that it was dirty work, but the work would really be done. A man did not exactly go into the wood to meet a nymph. He rather went with the hope of meeting a nymph. It was an adventure rather than an assignation. But the devil really kept his appointments, and even in one sense kept his promises, even if a man sometimes wished afterwards, like Macbeth, that he had broken them. Welcome to Pints with Chesterton, a podcast where two millennial women dive into the wonderful and whimsical works of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm Marie.
And I'm Grace. On today's episode, we are discussing the sixth chapter of part one of The Everlasting Man, The Demons and the Philosophers. Marie, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
Good. Also doing well.
Good.
Tonight, I almost forgot that I could have a pint, but then I remembered that I could, but I didn't. Yay! I record these podcasts from my office because it's just easier, and I forgot to bring a beer with me, but gratefully, because of all of the random crawfish boils and things that we had, there was one in the staff fridge.
Yay!
So fantastic. It's not anything very exciting, it's just like a Michelob Ultra, but here we are.
But we'll take it.
Yeah.
And at least one of us is. So I went to go make a drink tonight, and I realized we hosted some of our friends over the weekend, and I had used the end of my bourbon.
Oh no.
To make drinks. So I was pretty sad, but I ate a cocktail cherry to make myself feel better. And then I came up here with the water. So,
oh my gosh.
There you go.
I thought about you when I was in the grocery store yesterday because I saw the maraschino cherries and I was like, I can buy these because I'm an adult.
I actually had a really exciting revelation over the weekend that apparently Costco from time to time sells those really expensive, amazing cocktail cherries, the maraschino, amaretto, whatever cherries, in a 2-pack for like the same price as what you can get them for one jar anywhere else. So I am going to try to go to Costco.
because like I'm an adult.
It's like really not about the alcohol, it's about the cherry. But this water is good because we have had the most beautiful weather, and I took my kids to the pool today, and then we were just like, I was playing soccer in the backyard with my nephews tonight, and it was just a wonderful day, and water is perfect for what we've been up to.
Awesome. Very summery.
Yes. You went on a trip last week?
I did. Yeah. I went to South Florida to Ave Maria to the Focus training. They had a couple of days where they invited campus ministers down. So I got to meet our new missionaries, which was awesome. We have two new, I actually have three new ones, but we already knew the third. So I got to meet them. So that was really fun. And we got to just hang out with our team and go to the beach one day and just kind of introduce the new ones to the community, or at least part of the community. So
nice.
It was fun.
Did you guys drive or fly?
We flew, which on the way back we had all sorts of crazy experiences trying to get back because there was weather in Houston and we had to fly through Houston, and so we had to spend the night in Houston, and it was like,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, we had like a crazy Uber scary experience in Florida where like the Uber app just like assigned me a new driver while we were in the car of another driver, and the driver that we were with spoke zero English, and then we didn't speak any Spanish, so we like couldn't communicate with him at all. And
oh, no.
And then there was like not service for us to use Google Translate, and it was just like,
oh no,
it was wild. So like he was like calling Uber on his phone in Spanish, and we were calling Uber on our phone in English, and like, but we like had no idea. We're like not being tracked like in this Uber with this random guy, and we're like,
that is
We've
crazy.
Just felt unsafe. And anyway, there's like a whole bunch of other things that happened within that 45-minute drive to the airport with him that we were like, are we actually going to make it to the airport? I don't know. It was pretty crazy. So, but gratefully, praise God, he turned out to be just, you know, an average Uber driver, and the app was the thing that messed us up. But
okay, anyway. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. But that for a minute scary, there, we were though. Unsure. So,
yeah. I finished reading Howard's End.
Oh, how was it?
In the time. It was really good and very interesting. They're basically like he's trying to talk about the dangers of materialism versus idealism and having basically a balance in morality and these things is difficult and how a lot of people fail when they try to, or I guess when they've embraced a life of materialism or idealism, they often can't see the whole picture basically, and they don't live super moral lives. It would be an interesting discussion book. I'm gonna try to get one of my friends here to read it so that I can talk to somebody about it more in depth. But the characters are very fascinating and some of them infuriating, but in a good way. I'm glad I read it.
Infuriating, but in a good way.
Yeah,
I'd like to know what that means.
Well, there's one of the characters is pretty flawed and he seems pretty blind to it, but he does have a great transformation and sort of journey through the end of the book. So it's very satisfying, I think. Have you been reading anything?
I'm trying to think. So I was mostly just like diving into the Focus Blue Book. I think I talked about that last time.
That was
just trying to finish it before we got there. So that was the main thing I was reading. I don't know if I mentioned that I restarted St. Francis.
You did. Chesterton, you said you Saint were going Francis. To.
Yeah. So I'm still listening to that. Nice. But yeah, it's just sort of, I don't know, a summer happy read. I'm like,
it's so good.
Yeah. So I haven't gotten too much into anything else yet, but I'm hoping to, like, over the next few weeks, I'll have some more time, I think so.
Yeah, that's great. St. Francis is one of the first books that really, hagiographies that really made me feel like the saint was a real person who I would really like and, like, could really know, which is a talent that Chesterton has. Okay, well, let's dive in. This is chapter 6 of The Everlasting Man, and as the title says, it's about demons and philosophers. Last time we talked about mythology, and we talked about paganism a lot, and that was the good paganism. That was the paganism of seeking beauty but not knowing from where all beauty comes. And it, you know, wasn't perfect, but as I read in the quote at the beginning, it was this sort of like sort of happy and hilarious when he talks about like some of the nonsense of these mythologies. And he is now contrasting it with something that converged with that good paganism, and it's sort of a bad paganism, a demonic paganism.
Yeah. So he says, in the very first page of this chapter, he said, if we have called the first sort of mythology the daydream, we might very well call the second sort of mythology the nightmare. I thought that was a good, like, kind of explanation of it. And there I think he's trying to say that it, like, one sort of leads to the other.
Yeah.
Or tends to.
Yes.
But there's one that he likes because it's just sort of like frivolous and, you know, fun.
Yes.
And then the other one becomes too practical and gets into some dark things.
Yes. And he talks about in that first section how man is basically, what does he say? He's practically insane until he's sanctified. It's only when a man reaches sanctity that he reaches sanity. And how basically important morality and sanctity are for societies that are going to function well. He talks about a few different groups and sort of misconceptions about history in the first section of this chapter that are interesting. He talks about Spain and the Aztecs, and then in South America, and then he talks about Rome and Carthage. And one interesting thing that he brought up was that with all of these societies where demons are worshipped, or some sort of demonic presence is worshipped, there's human sacrifice, and particularly this hatred or lack of care for children.
Yeah.
And that really hit home.
Totally. Reading. Yeah. I want to talk about that. I want to first say something about, you mentioned like he was contrasting the Spaniards and the South Americans.
Yes.
He says at some point, basically, that people will look at the sins of the Spaniards who are going to South America to, you know, basically in conquest. Yes. And all of this kind of stuff. And so how they sort of go against what like a Christian ideal would be, and the Spaniards who are claiming to be Christian, you know, and going to these places. Yeah. And are in some ways, and then in other ways are doing these atrocities, you know. And so he says how people will defend the South Americans against the Spaniards, saying like basically that the Spaniards, look how sinful they were, like messing with this like sinless South American like people or whatever. And Chesterton's like, that's just kind of ridiculous to say that, like, just because one is sinful doesn't mean the other one is sinless. And he yeah. says, it may be reasonable enough that he should say that Spaniards were sinful, but why in the world should he say that the South Americans were sinless, especially because of the, he says, incessant human sacrifice accompanied by horrible torments. It's like, this is yes. a reality of what's happening. So you shouldn't excuse yes. what the Spaniards did. But also there's like this reality that these peoples were doing like pretty horrible things to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And
not
so
not pretty, straight up horrible.
Yeah. yeah.
Really and bad.
Right. And so, yeah, I think that we can tend to do that. We can like tend to canonize somebody who is being bullied in some way, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
But it
just the because, victim.
Yeah, just yeah. because somebody is the victim doesn't mean that they also are like perfect or something like that.
Yes.
So I think that was an important thing to kind of point yeah. out, because we can tend to look beyond that. But he did say something too about that where, he says the Christian is only worse because it is his business to be better. Yes. And I did think that that was an important point to say too. And I yes. think that's something that like, even today, if we look at, you know, there's been these scandals in the Catholic Church, right? With the priesthood and all this kind of stuff. And the same sort of thing happens across like other organizations and other, you know, things in sure. our society. But yeah. We feel it, I think, all the worse because we're supposed to be better, because we have a yes. higher ideal. And so
because
I think
we know better. Too.
Yeah, exactly. So it we does carry like more of a weight. Yeah. Because of that. So I think it's important that he points that out too. Like the Spaniards yeah. should have known better because they were Christian. And so you do have to say yeah. that, but also that doesn't mean that you should canonize the victim. And I don't no. want to put a parallel there of, you know, like the current scandals, like that's not
no,
what I meant
no,
to
no,
say.
No.
But
it's a good analogy though.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway.
No, I totally agree. And I actually read a history of Our Lady of Guadalupe and like all of everything that led up to her appearance in Mexico.
Ooh, send that
and
to me. I would like to read that.
It
it's
is
coming up a lot.
Yeah, she pursued me the last few years, and I finally read this history and my mind was blown. People are definitely uneducated about this history, and Cortez and a number of the priests who went with him to the New World, as they called it, mm-hmm. Were pretty holy men, like I would say almost to the point of sainthood, but they brought along a whole lot of soldiers with them who were not mm-hmm. as holy. And as you said, because they're Christians, because they're Catholics, they should have been better because they knew better, because they had a moral code. Mm-hmm. But it really is like this. Chesterton makes the perfect parallels between the Spaniards and South America and then Carthage and Rome, because when the Spaniards find out the amount of human sacrifice that's happening with South America, they, like, Cortez says in one of his letters, like, basically, like, we have to put a stop to this. Like, we can't just leave and pretend like we don't know that this is happening now. Like, God has ordained that, like, we have to try to stop all of this murder. And it was, there was human sacrifice in Carthage as well. And Rome and Israel were so horrified by the extent of human sacrifice that they came together to put a stop to what was happening in Carthage.
Yeah, and I thought it was cool that he said they came together, like, because they had this, like, common enemy in a way. Like, it was, like, this belief. And he said something about how, like, the next time that happened is when when Rome and Israel come together in the church, which I thought was kind of a cool parallel as well.
Totally. But he, you know, makes many interesting points when he's talking about these societies. But he says that two things that I think are really important. He says it's important not to talk about these things a lot and not in detail. And I think he's so wise about that. Like, he doesn't need to describe atrocities that you could commit or that people have committed, because what does it do? It only fills people's minds with those things. And and he says to the innocent mind, it's, you know, almost incomprehensible. And then and that made me think of his own struggle when he was young with the demonic and with the occult, and how keenly he must have felt this as he was, like, writing this section of, like, he felt a temptation to despair and to, like, give in to the occult. And didn't. And, like, came out on the other side and is talking about these things.
Did I talk about on here a few episodes? Did I talk about reading Lord of the Rings for Lent and meditating on Denethor and the Palantir? Did I talk about that here?
You talked about reading the Lord of the Rings, but you did not talk about that.
That part really struck me this year when I was reading it. So if anyone's read Lord of the Rings, he has this, like, it's sort of like a crystal ball, I guess, but he's able to see, like, far countries, like, in it, and see what's happening in those far countries. And Denethor is, like, the steward of a nation. So he's sort of like a king, but not quite. And so he's trying to protect, he's trying to, like, build up his kingdom to protect against the enemy, who is evil and is, like, creating these new armies. But he spends so much time looking into this Palantir to, like, see what the enemy is doing, that the darkness of what the enemy is doing and what he's been, like, looking and seeing the whole time sort of overtakes his mind, and he's driven to despair, because all he can see is the darkness in front of him, and he can't see the reality of the, like, good things that are happening beyond his sight. So he can't see Frodo and Sam climbing up the mountain with the ring. He can't see Aragorn going on the paths of the dead and, like, releasing this army. Like, he doesn't see, like, all these good things that are happening because he's so focused on the darkness. And then that does ultimately, like, lead him to despair and a death of despair. And so I that was just such a, like, strong image for me recently, that I think it goes along with this too, that if we spend too much time looking at the darkness and looking at the reality of, of atrocity, like you were saying, it can overtake us, because we're just, we're not meant to, like, take, ponder that sort of, and, like, look at that sort of evil for long. So
it's like Philippians.
Thinking, like,
about what is good and
good
lovely and
Yeah, like, and that's what they say too, even the spiritual life. Like, if you recognize the presence of the enemy and he's tempting you or speaking lies to you, the worst thing you can do is engage that and talk to him, like, about it. And the best thing you can do is just turn your eyes completely away from it and look at Jesus and, like,
And turn to his word.
And ponder the truth against those lies.
So, that is so good, Grace. Yes, that it's like Tolkien was inspired by this very idea.
What else is new? Tolkien and Lewis inspired by Chesterton.
I know. They're all friends. They're all in heaven together, I hope.
I hope so. Let's have a beer with them when we get there.
I know. Pints with all three. So he One thing I also liked in this first section was he gives this example of like, I think a Jewish man committing some atrocity. And there's like, it's so funny because he talks about all of the journalists commenting on this crime or event throughout Europe. And they're decrying the Jewish faith because, you know, because a Jewish man committed this crime. Mm-hmm. And Chesterton says, like, no, this was a crazy, immoral person, basically. And this mm-hmm. isn't a reflection of the entire faith of this people. And in no way and in any other situation would we say, you know, like, a woman... This is just an example, but a woman committed this crime, so all women are evil. Right. You know, he says we wouldn't say things like that. And I actually really appreciated this because there are all these modern claims that Chesterton is an anti-Semite. And he's not. I think he judges people. That sounds so... That's not exactly what I mean. But I think he looks at each person according to who... you know, just who they are as with their personal merit. He's not like judging a whole group by any means. I mean, if he were doing that, he wouldn't have had half the friends that he had.
Right.
Who were totally different from him. But talk about the other,
No, you go.
The other thing that he, talks about as far as like worshiping, evil is he says that in contrast with the Greeks who undertook to make the most beautiful statues and images that they could possibly create, the societies that worship Satan basically make the most hideous images that they can possibly make. And in the beginning, in that quote that I read where it says that Satan keeps his appointments and his promises to some extent.
Yeah.
It's like... you know, something actually happens when people participate in that kind of behavior. And so they think that it can accomplish everything, right? So they keep giving themselves over to it. They see there's some power in it. But it's not the kind of power that, like, Almighty God has. And so he he has this interesting line about the sky cracking, like, or the... And
cracking like a mirror at like the ugliness of the idol. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But. I also, like you mentioned earlier about in this, I mean, I just, in my mind, it's such a bold contrast, right? Like the type of paganism that Chesterton would call like harmless would be like just this very like kind of fun, whimsical, like kind of, you think about like storybooks and fairy tales and like, you know, even
the
just
nymph in the
even
woods.
The Greek mythologies that are like very just like, whimsical and stuff. And that's one thing. It's very, in my mind, it's very colorful. It's very just like, like you could tell it in a kid's story. And then this other one is very like just evil. It's devious. It's dark. It's trying to accomplish something through shady means. And he mentions specifically the idea that there's like a hatred of childhood or the idea of childhood. You mentioned that earlier. What was your thought about that?
I think that I see that today in my own life. I see that there's a pervasive attitude about childhood and children that is disturbing. And I don't think it's necessarily people's fault all the time. But everything that he talks about as having happened in these past societies and like witches preventing births of children and things like that, it's happening today. I mean, we're abortion is the most rampant maybe that it's ever been. And there's just such a confusing attitude about life and childhood. And Chesterton is the person to pioneer childhood. He loves children. Yeah. He loves childhood. He loves playfulness and joy. And, you know, if anybody's going to defend this and bring people's eyes back to what is right. It's him.
Yeah. I was just kind of, when I read that, I was like pondering, what is it about childhood that the diabolical like hates? And I was thinking like Jesus's line about how unless we turn and become like children, we cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And that's a line that comes up for me a lot. And I'm pondering like, what does it mean to be a child, like such that God would tell us to be like children? And I think it's just this like ultimate freedom and surrender to the plan of the Father. And that's the opposite of what the enemy wants us to do, is to kind of like take life by the reins and try to control and contrive, like, and get what we think we want in the moment while stamping on everybody else. And so I feel like there's this idea that we can get into as we get older of like, like, I'm an adult, like we said earlier, to bring that full circle. But like in a more like serious way of like, oh, well, I don't need help. Like, I'm in charge of my life. Like, I can get what I want. Like, and it becomes this very self-focused and self-reliant attitude that actually breaks us off from a relationship with God. And almost like this idea of like a pagan in the bad sense, like going to control and contrive by means of dark things like black magic and stuff. Like, I'm going to control my reality in a way that is not surrendered and not open to a different plan, or not trusting in the goodwill of the Father. Something that's like, just like a grasping or a controllingness.
I think you're so right about that.
And children are like an icon of that, what we should be, rather than what we tend to act like whenever we turn in on ourselves.
And there's something so beautiful and innocent about a child, especially a child that's like raised in a loving home and in a safe home. They wouldn't think of these things. They wouldn't think that people could do some of these things to each other. And I think that too, like when we think about being a child, think about the innocence of a child and how good they would be to each other. I mean, yes, they're silly with each other, and sometimes they're not, you know, they're not nice for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or whatever, but they genuinely care. If their little friend starts crying, they want to, you know, they want to do something about it. They don't want to, you know, it's like that innocence, which is so, I mean, Innocent Smith is, there's just so many connections in all of Chesterton's.
It's so true.
Works.
But yeah, I think it is too. It's like when you, I'm thinking about too, how people will get really annoyed or frustrated with children today, even in the church, like when you hear like a child crying or acting up and somebody is like, like they need to be quiet, they need to be silent, you
take
know,
them to the cry room.
Yeah, exactly. But even just like out in society, like if you're at a restaurant or you see a kid and they're like pitching a fit or having a meltdown or whatever, and people will just freak out. And I don't know, I was just pondering like, why do we freak out? Like, why are we so annoyed by this? And I kind of wonder if it's because we can't accept the child within ourselves that is like crying out for who knows what reason. You know,
we're just like blocking that out.
Yeah. Like, we don't want to deal with the fact that like, that's who we are. Like, I see toddlers all the time having a meltdown and I'm like, bro, I feel you. Like, I'm having a meltdown too. And I don't know why. I don't know.
I'm not allowed to cry out about it. I have to be quiet over here.
Yeah. But I feel like there's freedom in the reality of recognizing that like all of us are children at heart and we don't know what's going on. And we're like, you know, Job in the end of Job where he's like, I don't know anything. I thought I knew everything and I don't know anything at all, you know? And I'm just crying out to God and I have no control. And like, but there's a freedom in that. And I think our culture is so anxious and depressed because we have so much pressure to create our whole reality, you know? Like, I'm an adult that has to control my whole reality. And so when you see a child and just their almost like their freedom and just expression and their freedom to like be small and be like, I'm not in control of my life. I don't know, maybe that, and that's just a theory, but maybe that like pokes at us in some way.
I definitely
can't accept that in ourselves.
I think you're on the right track there. I also think people are just not around children enough.
Yeah.
I think they don't spend time with children, and so many people when I lived in California were like, oh, I just don't like children. I won't ever have them. I just don't like children. It's like, how can you not like children? You were a child.
You were a child, yeah. And in some ways, you're a child.
I think people think, I think they say that because they don't want to engage with it. Like, and they don't want to, they don't want to give up a lifestyle. They don't want responsibility in that way.
I think
they just have no idea, though, how fun it is.
That's so true. But I think that, like, we all can tend to, especially if we're privileged enough to have, like, a certain semblance of control in our lives, we tend to just try to get rid of everything in our lives that makes us uncomfortable and just kind of hide in a certain space or create a world around ourselves where we don't have to deal with anything uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so we do kind of push children to the edges, like, oh, you have to go sit in the cry room, or you can't come out to eat at a restaurant, or you have to, like, you know, exist in this separate reality. We do this with the elderly too, actually. Like, oh, you have to go to this nursing home. Like, you can't be, like, a part of the rest of the society, because maybe it's because children and the elderly are not, like, quote unquote productive, and we kind of have, like, an obsession with productivity.
They need help
or something. Yeah. Anyway, there's so many things to think about. That got my mind spinning when I read his thought about that.
Oh, totally. But if you do have a child, bring them out everywhere, because people need to see them.
Amen.
And they just bring a lot of joy wherever they go. And they should be in mass or church, wherever you go. As one of my sisters-in-law always says, if the church isn't crying, it's dying.
Amen to that.
And it's so true. It's very true. Okay, so let's move on. We're going to just briefly talk about the second section of the chapter, which was on philosophies. And I say briefly because he's going over a bunch of things that he has talked about previously. One of which is that something that he talks about in Orthodoxy, in the chapter called The Maniac, he talks about the circle versus the cross. And in his section of talking about Buddhism in this chapter, he talks about the Asiatic symbol of the snake eating its tail, and how that basically that symbol, it seems to contain everything, but then it really contains nothing, and it's so closed on itself, and it can't ever expand, and it can't be enlarged. And then he talks about the cross extending out forever, eternally, in every direction, and he says, while never losing its shape. And I thought that was beautiful, but we've talked about that before. Did you have any other thoughts on that, Grace?
I think we have, like, sort of a different understanding. Sometimes when we think of a circle, we think of it as, like, this infinity, but Chesterton does talk about in our Orthodoxy how it's like you can just kind of be turning in on yourself again and again, and you're not, like, you don't have this, like, expansive view. So the image of the cross is so interesting. I never would have considered this unless he had talked about it in Orthodoxy, but just, like, how it can expand and expand and expand, but yet still maintain its, like, what it is, its shape. And it's, just the structure of it. And I think that in my mind, like, just kind of as a sign of the church too, how it's so, it's expansive. It's meant to be universal and expansive, and it can contain so much. And yet it still has this, like, structure, this skeleton, of the cross that never changes and is, like, solid, something that we can, like, hang our hat on, you know? I think that's so interesting. And it is just so interesting how there's this natural symbolism to these religions or these philosophies, as he says. And that's the thing too, is that in this second half of the chapter, he's sort of contrasting, like, what is, and he started this a couple chapters ago, but, like, what is religion? And how is it different from philosophy? And I thought it was interesting that in this chapter, he talked about how there were all of these ancient pagans who were philosophers, and they never really saw any sort of contradiction in their philosophy and their religion. So you had these people like Aristotle, who lived in these pagan times, and yet he's, like, doing this philosophy. And they saw them almost like in separate categories. Like they weren't really like clashing with each other.
Like it doesn't come into life. It's just like these abstract thoughts over here and then life
and then
over
this
here.
Like religion over here with its festivals and its like worship and its whatever, but it's like they're not really like combining the two. And I think that's what he's starting to say about how Christianity like actually was the first to like take the philosophy, the reason of the reality of the world around and these theories about like existence and stuff, and then apply it to this worship of the God that is real and like created all of these things. And anyway, he doesn't get into it in this chapter, but that's, I think, where he's headed.
Yeah. So one of the things that he says is that, as you mentioned, these are, he considers more entities to be philosophies rather than religions. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about why he would claim that. And I was just Googling the definition of religion. I'm like, what is, and the first thing that comes up when you Google that is service and worship of God. And then that really made it, that clarified things for me as I continued to read the chapter, because it's like, that's not what Buddhism claims to do. That's not what Hinduism claims to do. That's not what a lot of these faiths claim to do. And so I thought it's a useful distinction to say philosophy versus religion.
It does if you're trying to explain, I think, the difference between, like a Confucianism or a Buddhism versus like Christianity or even Islam. But I think even in that, you have to ask the question, in which Chesterton is doing in this whole book, is like, what do you mean by God? When you say God, like worship of God, it's like, well, what does that mean? And what is God? Is it God or is it the gods? And that's what he was kind of like distinguishing between in the last chapter. But yeah, in this chapter, talking about like Confucianism, for example, he says Confucius was not a religious founder or even a religious teacher, possibly not even a religious man, which is interesting. He was not an atheist. He was apparently what we call agnostic, but the really vital point is that it is utterly irrelevant to talk about his religion at all. He said he was not there to bring a message from heaven to humanity, but to organize China, and he must have organized it exceedingly well. He says he even dealt with morals, but he bound them up with manners. In other words, he was trying to create a society that could exist in harmony on Earth, but he wasn't really talking about things that were transcendent. You know, like things that go beyond the present moment. And so, you can't really call that a religion. It may be a philosophy. It may be a very good philosophy, possibly, you could argue. But it's different categorically from what we mean by religion.
I liked that he said he will be offensive to people, but he's not meaning this to be offensive to people. Like the fact that he's calling these philosophies. It really does put it into perspective. The last thing that I wanted to just read a little something from the last part of the paragraph or the last part of the chapter. That circle or disk of the sun set up in the morning of the world by the remote Egyptian has been a mirror and a model for all the philosophers. They have made many things out of it and sometimes gone mad about it, especially when, as in these Eastern sages, the circle became a wheel going round and round in their heads. But the point about them is that they all think that existence can be represented by a diagram instead of a drawing. Mm-hmm. And the rude drawings of the childish myth makers are a sort of crude and spirited protest against that view. They cannot believe that religion is not really a pattern, but a picture. Still less can they believe that it is a picture of something that really exists outside our minds. Sometimes the philosopher paints the disc all black and calls himself a pessimist. Sometimes he paints it all white and calls himself an optimist. Sometimes he divides it exactly into halves of black and white and calls himself a dualist, like those Persian mystics to whom I wish there were a space to do justice. None of them could understand a thing that began to draw the proportions just as if they were real proportions, disposed in the living fashion which the mathematical draftsman would call disproportionate. Like the first artist in the cave, it revealed to incredulous eyes the suggestion of a new purpose in what looked like a wildly crooked pattern. He seemed only to be distorting his diagram when he began for the first time in all the ages to trace the lines of a form and of a face.
Mm. So good.
It's so good.
It's so good. Gosh.
And I just tear up thinking a little bit about that. Like, Jesus's face is so, that is so full of hope.
Yeah.
It's like all these symbols and talismans that he talks about in this whole chapter. Yeah. And then he's like, and then the face, like the holy face of Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. And he talks about how like, yeah, nature, he says somewhere where like nature is really looking for something. Nature is always looking for the supernatural. Like it's not satisfied by the disk of the sun. Like it's not satisfied by like these things that only nature can kind of like bring. It has to go beyond it to something that's much more mystical and much more multifaceted than we can ever imagine. And it's not just a pattern. It's something that's more personal and more relatable than that. And like, it's not that pattern is bad or anything like that, but I remember having a conversation with one of my students one time, and she was asking me why all these stories in the Bible instead of this like basically formula of doctrines of belief? Like, why do we not just have a list of like doctrines of belief only? And why do we have these like confusing stories that are in scripture? And I just like, I kind of pondered that for a minute, and then I just started talking. Like, I really think that a story is just so much more mystical because there's so much depth to it that you can't see the pattern, like the circle that we were talking about. It's like it's too contained, it's like too cut and dry, and it doesn't leave any room for mystery or any room for mysticism. I don't know if that makes sense, but to enter into a story, there's so many layers and different experiences of the same story every time you read it, and different aspects of it to ponder and to meditate on. And it's just so much more like a person than it just is. Like a formula.
Yes, it is. And I'm terrible at math, so I feel that even more than most, but it's not just 1 + 1 = 2. It's like the story tells us so much more than any sum could. I really liked how he talks in that last quote that I just read, how he talks about the picture, the drawing, and he's, as we've said previously, a creative mind, and so he can visualize that himself. But I think even people who don't think that they're artistic or creative have this creativity in them. It just manifests differently in every person.
And it's not to say that the math of everything isn't important or isn't part of the picture or whatever, like, because it obviously is. There's like reason, and there's sort of mathematics behind things, which can be very beautiful. But
and it's behind like our society, like all the building blocks of our society and all of our architecture and everything. I really like math.
Yeah, totally. But like, I think there's in a certain sense a math that's way beyond our comprehension. That's something we could never fit into our brains. And I always go back to Job, but like, so does Chesterton. So I feel like I learned that from him. But but I feel like that's kind of what God does when he shows up at the end of Job, and he starts taking Job on a tour of the universe and basically being like, look how crazy this stuff is. Like, you can't fit this in your brain. Like, you can't figure this out. There's no formula about why you're suffering. And like, there's reasons, but that's different than like just this nice, neat little formula that you can tie up with a bow and then be done with it. You know, it's like, it's just so far beyond our comprehension. And only stories, I think, can really get at that.
They can start to hint at the truth. Yeah. Right. I agree. Well, wonderful. Do you have any other notes about this chapter before we wrap things up?
I don't think so. I probably will have more thoughts when we get to the next chapter.
Yes. So. And the next chapter, chapter 7, is the one that we'll be doing it on here, but then in about a month, we'll be doing it with the Chesterton Society. So this is our trial run. This is our test run.
And that next chapter is about the war of the gods and demons, which is interesting. So can't wait to read that one.
Yeah. What are you grateful for this week, Grace?
What am I grateful for this week?
Michelob Ultra in your work
fridge. I am, honestly. I like cracked this open right before we started recording and I was like, wow, that tastes like unusually good. But maybe it's just because we're in the heat of summer and like it just like really refreshing. Yeah. So I am really grateful for that. Yeah. And I'm grateful. I think I may have said this last time, but I'm grateful for the stillness of summer around here because our work and community sort of diminishes in the summer pretty drastically from how it is the rest of the school year when all the students flee campus. Yeah. And so it's been kind of a cool, just like chill, restful, like we're working and we're planning and things like that, but it's not a whole lot of stuff outside going on. And also the ones who are left in the office, we lose a lot of our ministers and missionaries in the summer because they're off at trainings and people are in and out of the office for vacation. And so it's a smaller crew in the office. So we get to kind of know each other a little bit better and stuff. And so that's been so nice. So that's been good too. It's been a gift in its own way to just kind of like breathe for a minute and reevaluate everything and just kind of spend some time just being and praying and pondering. And so that's been really good. I'm grateful for that. How about
that
you?
Is good. I am grateful for having my family around me. We've had some lovely times over the last couple days with my family, and it's just really nice that they're close enough to do things with on a daily or weekly basis easily. Because as I've learned with friendships and family, it's hard to stay close when you're farther apart. You just can't drive great distances all the time to see each other. So really grateful to have so many of them close by and just the opportunity to be a presence in so many of my nieces and nephews' lives and for them to affect me as well.
That's a huge gift.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, we'll see you guys next week. I'm looking forward to it. May you all enjoy lives of wit
and whimsy. Cheers.
Cheers.